All right, this is part two of the Ordinance of Covenanting. We're going to be talking about vows and oaths. A reminder that the fourth term of communion begins by saying, public social covenanting is an ordinance of God, obligatory on churches and nations under the New Testament. So we want to talk about vows, and then we want to talk about oaths, and we want to do so with the understanding that we're going to be looking at the doctrine of covenanting. And so we want to consider, as we did in some of the preliminary matters, want to consider these things as preliminary matters, precisely because in all covenanting, you're going to have elements of oath-taking or vowing or both, as we'll see. So we want to look at them with an eye to, or that notion before us, that this is going to have bearing on the doctrine of covenanting. When we talk about vows, we're going to be talking about vows first. Vows have a peculiar reference to God, directly to God. When we talk about oaths, the reference to God is more of an indirect one, although not always. But oaths are of a little bit different nature. And understanding oaths a little bit more, or separately from vows, again, it is something that will be helpful when we consider the doctrine of covenanting. Because, as I say, covenanting wraps into it aspects of the making of vows or the taking and giving of oaths. So both of these elements are going to be involved when we talk about covenanting. When we talk about oaths, we really have to further distinguish, as our confession does, and I'm following the both the general outlines of the confession on lawful oaths and vows. But we're going to try to give more detail. We're going to try to look at it in terms of our end goal, which is looking at the doctrine of covenanting. But when we talk about oaths, we have to distinguish there between what are called assertory oaths, which generally have reference to telling the truth. It's a promise to tell the truth. Whereas a promissory oath, which is very much like unto a vow, is the assumption of an obligation that needs to be fulfilled sometime in the future. So we'll look at both of these aspects of oath-taking when we get to that part. And I think that I was hoping actually to get a little bit further tonight, but I think vows and oaths are all we're going to be able to cover tonight. So there's actually a fair bit there. And as is want to happen when I consider these things, very often other issues come up. So let's begin with the first question. What ought we to think of vows? So first of all, vows must be considered in connection with the subject of covenanting. That's our whole purpose in considering vows. We want to look at Psalm 50, verses 5, 14, and 16.
Psalm 50, verse 5. Gather my saints together unto me, those that have made a covenant with me by sacrifice. Verse 14. Offer unto God thanksgiving and pay thy vows unto the Most High. And verse 16. But unto the wicked God saith, what hast thou to do to declare my statutes, or that thou shouldest take my covenant in thy mouth?
Right. So vows are clearly of a religious nature, as we're going to see. Vow, and this is an important distinction about a vow. A vow is made to God alone. We're going to see with an oath that's not necessarily the case. Indirectly, all oaths are also made to God, but oaths are not under this kind of restriction. A vow is made to God alone. And various passages of Scripture actually make this point clear. Just want to look at a couple of them, Psalm 132:2 and Numbers 21:2.
Psalm 132, verse 2, how we swear unto the Lord and vowed unto the mighty God of Jacob. Numbers 21, verse 2, and Israel vowed a vow unto the Lord and said, if thou wilt indeed deliver this people into my hand, then I will utterly destroy their cities.
So vows are made to God alone. They're not to be made to any creature. And we're going to see that in Scripture, I think every verse we could possibly discuss regarding vows, except for one, the vows are being made to God alone. And in the case where they're not, we're going to look at it in just a minute, the fact is that those who profane the vow by making a vow to something other than God alone come under divine, not just criticism, but judgment. We need to remember that behind the doctrine of oaths and vows and covenanting, behind all of that is the third commandment. We're not to take the name of the Lord our God in vain. But behind that, we have to consider then who is God, and we need to understand that in this doctrine of oaths and vows and covenanting, because God is tied up in them, because an appeal in an oath is going to be made to him, a vow is made directly to him, because of that, there is an element of worship that has to be considered in all oaths and all vows. And that brings us to the second commandment, how God is to be worshipped. Right? We're not to make any graven images and so on. God alone, in other words, will tell us how he is to be worshipped. The acceptable way of worshipping him is limited by his word. And so what we call the regulative principle that pertains to worship pertains to the doctrine of oaths and vows, because at some point all oaths and vows are pieces of religious devotion. And we'll look at that again as well. Right, this connection of the vow to God is manifest in the manner in which it's said to be made. If we look, for example, at Genesis 28, verses 20 to 22.
Genesis 28, 20 to 22. And Jacob vowed a vow, saying, if God will be with me and will keep me in this way that I go, and will give me bread to eat and raiment to put on, so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then shall the Lord be my God, and this stone which I have set for a pillar shall be God's house, and of all that thou shalt give me, I will surely give a tenth unto thee.
So he's vowing to God. And importantly, again, he's vowing to the true God, because the fact is that you can't make a vow to any other. The idols of men's minds are creatures. Right? They're the creation, the imaginations, the vanities of fallen men. Or the suggestions of Satan, you know, spiritual delusions of the demonic forces, but they're not God, and therefore they are something arising from the creature rather than the creator. But no, Jacob, when he vows to God, and all vowing, as I indicated, all vowing, if we were to examine every passage, and we're not, because there are a lot of them, but if we were to examine them, God, the true God, is either explicitly or implicitly in view when a vow is made, excepting one case, which we're going to talk about again in a moment. All right, so there's the connection of the vow to God, which, again, confirms us that a vow is to be made to God alone, or God only, as well as the subject of the address when made. Sometimes this is how we know that vows are to be made to God only. The way a vow is made tells us as much, and we see that, for example, in 1 Samuel 1:11.
For Samuel 1:11, and she vowed a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if thou wilt indeed look on the affliction of thine handmaid, and remember me, and not forget thine handmaid, but wilt give unto thine handmaid a man-child, then I will give him unto the Lord all the days of his life, and there shall no razor come upon his head.
So there we have the case of Hannah and her vow to God. And we know, again, she's vowing to God. How? Because of the manner of her address. She addresses God directly in the vow. It's very clear, then, what's going on here. As I say, there's only one passage where a vow is represented as being made to another than God himself. But there, we're going to look at it. The judgments of God are denounced against men for making vows to the Queen of Heaven, but involves them in the guilt of idolatry. Jeremiah 44, 25 and 26.
Jeremiah 44, verses 25 and 26. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, saying, ye and your wives have both spoken with your mouths and fulfilled with your hand, saying, we will surely perform our vows that we have vowed to burn incense to the Queen of Heaven, and to pour out drink offerings under her. You will surely accomplish your vows and surely perform your vows. Therefore, hear ye the word of the Lord, all Judah that dwell in the land of Egypt. Behold, I have sworn by my great name, saith the Lord, that my name shall no more be named in the mouth of any man of Judah in all the land of Egypt, saying, the Lord God liveth.
All right, so there are a lot of things to note there. The Queen of Heaven, a term which the Romanists have actually applied to Mary, and there are, I know John Paul II, Carol Wojtyla, he claimed to have made a vow to Mary. There are a lot of prominent Mariologists in the Roman Church who are doing that. The Bible is very clear. Any vow you make to any creature is idolatry. And just in case it wasn't clear from the positive, remembering all things which are commanded imply that the contrary is prohibited. So when the law says to vow to God alone in a number of different ways, it really doesn't need to tell us that we're not allowed to vow to a creature. But here we have a case, one case, where vows are made to creatures, or a creature, and they stand condemned of the guilt of idolatry. Well, this is important because at some point we have to consider the doctrine of oaths and vows when it applies to our interaction with the church and with the nation state. If you don't have a church that professes the true religion or that is in violation of the regulative principle of worship, it's probably not a safe auspices under which to be entering into vows. Likewise, when we talk about a nation state, you know, making vows in the face of doing this or that to uphold an immoral or Christless constitution is idolatrous, precisely because you're now trying to take the true God into a covenant with, as we're going to see, with a nation that is clearly not in covenant with God, right? Clearly at odds. And so this creates problems from an ethical, moral standpoint for the kinds of roles that Christians can play in societies that are less than faithful Christian covenanted societies. There are implications to this. And so any vow that is intended to anything other than the true God is inherently idolatrous. And the problem we get with vows like oaths, you know, if someone were to tender a vow or suggest a vow vis-a-vis one of these societies, we can't take and impress upon, particularly an oath, we'll get to that, but we can't impress upon it our own sense. Right? And you can't change the reality of something simply by taking a vow with respect to it. You are not going to change a society, a community, a culture simply by taking a vow. All right, thus once men who had been idolaters were instructed in the claims of the Lord upon them and their obedience which they owed to him. What do? We see they make vows to him. For example, in Jonah 1:16.
Jonah 1:16. Then the men feared the Lord exceedingly and offered a sacrifice unto the Lord and made vows.
Yeah, and there's a lot of discussion from time to time about what is going on there. Clearly, one thing that is in view here is this. Those men are vowing to the true God. The word that's used for God there, the Lord, is that sacred name of God. They are invocating the God who is in covenant with his people, people of Israel at the time, and they're making their vows to him. That's clear. Now, how do they know to do that? Well, this is one of these verses where we can look and say, vowing like all matters of natural morality, vowing is something which, in fact, is written on the heart of man. Okay, there is a light of nature issue going on. But the manner of vowing is absolutely dependent upon special revelation. Because although you know by nature there is a God and that he's to be worshipped, you don't know who that God is or how he's to be worshipped. And yet here these mariners have been sufficiently instructed by Jonah with respect to this. So they've received special revelation. Nonetheless, the impulse to make these vows demonstrates that there is a natural impulse in the heart of man to respond to God in this way. It's all the more reason you need special revelation. Because without it, you're going to violate not only the first and second commandments, of course you're going to violate the third commandment. You're not going to keep the name of the Lord from being subjected to blasphemy. All right. A vow is a solemn promise made to God. Look at Deuteronomy 23:23.
Deuteronomy 23, verse 23. That which has gone out of thy lips thou shalt keep and perform, even a freewill offering, according as thou hast vowed unto the Lord thy God, which thou hast promised with thy mouth.
So it's a promise made to God. It's like a freewill offering. We're going to come back to that in a moment, that idea. Importantly, we should understand there's a lot in a vow that is very much like unto a promissory oath. A promissory oath. An oath taken with an eye to assuming an obligation and fulfillment in the future. There's a lot of similarities. And so they're sometimes mentioned together in that respect. For example, Numbers 30, verse 2.
Numbers 30, verse 2. If a man vow a vow unto the Lord or swear an oath to bind his soul with a bond, he shall not break his word. He shall do according to all that proceedeth out of his mouth.
And therefore, Scripture declares, vows were paid to the Lord. And we'll come back to this in contrast a little bit when we get to oaths. But oaths are also very often fulfilled by meeting an obligation to men. Because God is involved, as we're going to see when we talk about oaths, there's also this this vow aspect of any oath where you are going to be fulfilling a promise to God. So we'll see that hopefully a little bit more when we talk about oaths, that vows are very much like promissory oaths in several important ways. Now, because a vow is a solemn promise to God, then these vows are paid to the Lord. The vows are said to be paid by sacrifice and thanksgiving. Look at Nahum 1:15 and Psalm 61:8.
Nahum 1:15. Behold, upon the mountains, the feet of him that bringeth good tidings, that publisheth peace. O Judah, keep thy solemn feasts, perform thy vows, for the wicked shall no more pass through thee. He is utterly cut off.
Psalm 61, verse 8. So will I sing praise unto thy name forever, that I may daily perform my vows.
Okay, so vows, again, vows have this distinction, and we'll see it more clearly when we talk about the oath. Let's look at this word, the verb first, the verb vow, to make a vow. That verb is nadar, and it arises from the literal sense of beating out or threshing of grain. Right? We see that in other Semitic languages. I think I know Arabic has a cognate like unto this. I think Akkadian also has something very much like this, if I recall. It is attested in this sense one time in our Bible, in the Aramaic section of the book of Daniel. We find a form of this, the Aramaic word for threshing floor, which is idar, in Daniel 2:35.
Daniel 2, verse 35. Then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold broken to pieces together, and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away, that no place was found for them. And the stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth.
Okay, so there we see it's related to threshing floor. And in terms of etymology, the nun in Hebrew for nadar and the alep in Arabic, or not in Arabic, in Aramaic, excuse me, the alep in idar are both weak letters. And so the dar is the more permanent root, but we'll see in a moment that there are some other things that we need to consider here as well. All right, so it's related to, or has its root in this idea of a threshing. Nadar, to make a vow, is a threshing. And it's also cognate to words in Hebrew for sowing, winnowing, and scattering. So, for example, zara. And you may not immediately see, and there's another form of zara, two forms that are used here, one in Ruth 3:2, and then one in Genesis 26:12, that are going to be translated as sowing, winnowing, or scattering. So look at Ruth 3:2 and Genesis 26:12.
Ruth 3, verse 2. And now is not Boaz of our kindred, with whose maidens thou wast? Behold, he winnoweth barley tonight in the threshing floor.
Genesis 26, verse 12. Then Isaac sowed in that land, and received in the same year an hundredfold, and the Lord blessed him.
Okay, so, again, this is one of these things that have been sorted out by lexicographers and grammarians that demonstrate that there is this, these are all cognate words, that they're all related, all right, in the thinking of ancient Semitic people, and we're going to see in a moment there's some play on these Almost all Semitic words are triliteral. They have triliteral roots, three root letters. And these things get moved around a little bit to bring out different emphases as that goes. So, from this idea of a threshing of grain, a vowel, this word nadar came to signify falling out or dropping down as grain from the winnowing instrument upon the threshing floor, and by extension, it came to mean to offer willingly and freely. So, for example, look at 2 Samuel 15:8.
2 Samuel 15:8. For thy servant vowed a vow while I abode at Geshur in Syria, saying, if the Lord shall bring me again indeed to Jerusalem, then I will serve the Lord.
So if you think about the connection, the idea is that in winnowing, you are separating the wheat from the chaff, and the wheat, the grain, falls freely, it drops down freely to the floor, the threshing floor, whereas the chaff is blown by the wind, right? The grain is allowed to sort of fall by its own weight. And so there's this idea then of a freeness or a willingness that they've derived from this. So the corn or the grain falls willingly. The chaff is carried by some other force, the wind, off of the threshing floor. So that's how this came, the verb nadar came to mean to make a vow. From this root is actually derived the word meaning to separate or consecrate, which is nazar. And you can sort of see a little bit more there, I think, the connection, the relation to nadar, nazar. Especially if you, again, understand in terms of phonetics, that Dalit sound and that Zion sound are very closely aligned. We want to look at Numbers 6:2.
Speak unto the children of Israel and say unto them, but either man or woman shall separate themselves to vow a vow of a Nazarite to separate themselves unto the Lord.
Yeah, to vow a vow. Nadar. Neder, which we're going to see in a moment, the noun form. To vow a vow of a Nazarite. Nazar. And Christ is called a Nazarene. And the idea of Nazarite is attached to John the Baptist. Nazarites are, to use a term that is a little closer to what we might understand, Nazarites are covenanters. To be a Nazarite is to be a covenanter. Right? It's to be separated by a vow. It's to be under an obligation of a vow and an oath. And as it bears relation to the community or to other individuals in that community, other Nazarites, it makes you a covenanter. The noun vow, neder, and you can look and see that without our vowel points, it looks like the same word. And so, very clear that these words are related. The noun vow is put to denote the act then of offering or making a promise to God. Look, for example, Judges 11:39.
Judges 11:39. And it came to pass at the end of 2 months that she returned unto her father, who did with her according to his vow, which he had vowed, and she knew no man, and it was a custom in Israel.
Yeah, so that's Jephthah's famous vow. We're not going to discuss that here. But there's a vow that's been made. How? It's a promise to God. And importantly, it's understood to be a promise made most freely. Right? Entered into freely. He was not under any constraint to enter into that, any natural constraint. The vow then is sometimes made in a spontaneous effusion of gratitude, such as when David, when God gave him rest from all his enemies. We compare, again, Psalm 132, 2 and 3 with 2 Samuel 7, 1 to 3.
Psalm 132, verses 2 and 3. How he sware unto the Lord and vowed unto the mighty God of Jacob, surely I will not come into the tabernacle of my house, nor go up into my bed.
2 Samuel 7, verses 1 through 3. And it came to pass, when the king sat in his house, and the Lord had given him rest round about from all his enemies, that the king said unto Nathan the prophet, see now, I dwell in a house of cedar, but the ark of God dwelleth within curtains. And Nathan said to the king, go do all that is in thine heart, for the Lord is with thee.
Right, so David, God gives him rest, and we see in the psalm that he responds by vowing. Moreover, we know vows are often made in order to obtain some benefit, particularly from God. It's Psalm 66, 13 and 14.
Psalm 66, 13 and 14. I will go into thy house with burnt offerings. I will pay thee my vows, which my lips have uttered and my mouth had spoken when I was in trouble.
All right. And then the last thing, or the last few things we want to keep in mind with vows. Vows mustn't be made which are inconsistent with the requirements of the divine law, because the Lord will not accept what he has forbidden. You can't vow to give something or do something or be something that the Lord has forbidden. All right. Malachi 1:14.
But cursed be the deceiver which hath in a flock a male, and voweth and sacrifices unto the Lord a corrupt thing. For I am a great king, saith the Lord of hosts, and my name is dreadful among the heathen.
Yeah, we're never free to bring into a vow that we make to God something which he has forbidden. Right, so any kind of vow is only lawful when it is, in fact, wholly consistent with the requirements of the divine law. Now, this, too, has bearing on the position of covenanters and the degree to which they want to assimilate and participate, particularly in certain aspects of national life, right? There has to be this consideration. We'll see it in a little bit more detail toward the end of what we're going to be talking about tonight. But just keep in mind, you know, a vow is not going to make something acceptable that the divine law has already declared to be inconsistent with such a thing. This is an issue, by the way, when Jesus is addressing the people who say this is Corban. Right, it is consecrated, that is, by a vow to the Lord, and so they don't have to take care of, you know, mother or father, right? They don't have to honor mother and father in that regard. And the thinking of these Jews was, I've consecrated this to the Lord by a vow over here, and because I've done this and committed it over here, I'm relieved of this commandment over there. And this principle is really what's at stake. You can't place something in that category, a vow, if it's in violation of the law of God over here. Right? So that's not an acceptable it's not, not only is it not an acceptable vow, it's not a lawful vow. Nor ought we to promise what is beyond our power, for that would be to mock the Lord. Look at Leviticus 27, verse 8.
Leviticus 27, verse 8. But if he be poorer than thy estimation, then he shall present himself before the priest, and the priest shall value him. According to his ability that vowed, shall the priest value him.
According to the ability of the one who vowed, the priest will value him. Why is the priest making that kind of consideration? Because you're not allowed to vow to do something which is beyond your power. Right? To vow that I'm going to vow to God that I'm going to build a skyscraper by myself would be to vow to do something beyond my power. But people do this all the time. Now, it may be said, well, why would covenanters have made the kind of vows they did in the Psalm, League, and Covenant, if it turned out to be beyond their power? And the answer is, it's one thing when you make a vow to vow what is in your power or not. It's another thing if, after you've made that vow, it's gone out of your power to fulfill it. Right? In the first instance, you had a right to make a vow because it stood in your power to perform it. Is it possible for us to perform all of the provisions of the Psalm, League, and Covenant at this point? And the answer is no, and we'll talk about this more. This is exactly why when they renewed the covenants, they did them as they did at Arkansas. They renewed them according to their place and station. That is, according to the power that they had, they promised to try to uphold these things according to their place and station. Why didn't they renew them as they'd originally been taken? Well, because they no longer were in that capacity. The people who were in that capacity had broken covenant with God. Does that mean that we have a right to continue breaking covenant with God? The short answer is no, and we'll look at that more when we get into covenanting. All right? We're not relieved of the obligation, but when we own that obligation, our owning of that obligation, particularly in an act of covenant renewal, should not exceed our power. We shouldn't promise something to God beyond what we can deliver. So we're not going to promise to God that the whole nation is going to covenant with God, or renew covenant with God. Why? We don't represent the nation. We don't represent the national church. We're not doing it as the church, the national church, or as the supreme magistrate of the nation. Do they have that obligation? That's a different question. We'll have to discuss later. But we don't have that in our power. Okay, so we're not going to renew covenant with the idea that we do have that in our power. Nonetheless, as a church, as a society, the people who entered into those covenants, was it within their power to do it? Again, the short answer is yes. Did they fulfill the obligation? The short answer is no. Does their covenant breaking relieve the following generations from the obligation that they've entered into by this vow, this national vow, this ecclesiastical vow? And the answer is no. Right, it's the same proposition. Think about it this way. When God created man, he had the capacity to keep the moral law. Man was made upright. God made him upright. By his fall, he lost all ability to keep the law. Does God suspend the law and say, well, you're not responsible to keep the whole law now just because morally you're incapacitated? The answer is no. Because man is the one who made himself incapacitated. Right? The nation and the church, through their duplicity, their sin, their backsliding, they made themselves incapacitated. Therefore, the obligation remains even if you can't do it. You have to rely then upon the grace of God. And we talked about this last time. This is why in covenanting we have to go back to the covenant of grace, and we're looking for the grace of God. Because God is the one who's going to have to make up that difference, if you will. Right? It's going to take revival. It's going to take a spiritual miracle. But that's what God does. That's not for us to do. Ours is a duty. It belongs to God to give the power to perform that duty. All right. Additionally, there are some vows of women and children are not accepted because they interfere with services which they owe their families. For example, in Numbers 30, 6 to 8.
Numbers 30, verses 6 through 8. And if she had at all an husband, when she vowed or uttered aught out of her lips, wherewith she bound her soul, and her husband heard it, and held his peace at her in the day that he heard it, then her vows shall stand, and her bonds wherewith she bound her soul shall stand. But if her husband disallowed her on the day that he heard it, then he shall make her vow which she vowed, and that which she uttered with her lips, wherewith she bound her soul, of none effect, and the Lord shall forgive her.
Or if we're talking about things lawful, vows may not be accepted. In matters over which husbands or fathers have a superior power with respect to the people trying to make those vows. Again, Numbers 33 to 5.
Numbers 30, verses 3 through 5. If a woman also vow a vow unto the Lord and bind herself by a bond, being in her father's house in her youth, and her father hear her vow and her bond wherewith she hath bound her soul, and her father shall hold his peace at her, then all her vows shall stand, and every bond wherewith she hath bound her soul shall stand. But if her father disallow her in the day that he heareth not any of her vows or of her bonds wherewith she hath bound her soul shall stand, and the Lord shall forgive her because her father disallowed her.
Okay, so there are limitations to vows. Right? You can't. Vows are not a way to escape legitimate relations in life, for example. You can't say, well, I made this vow over here, and therefore that cancels an obligation I have over here. This is, by the way, one reason why children have to have the consent of their parents in order to marry, right? Because they can't make this vow to God over here and then try to juxtapose that to a pre-existing obligation which they had under the law of God and the fifth commandment over there. Okay, that's why Jesus takes to task those who declare their possessions Corban, devoted to God, and thereby try to escape honoring father and mother. It's the same principle that's involved. What they've tried to do is take something out of the realm of what had already been determined by law and escape the obligation of the law by making this vow to God. Right? They tried to create a legal loophole, but the doctrine of oaths and vows is telling us you can't do that. Right? You can't slip out from under this by making this sort of end run and grabbing hold of God and saying, therefore, I grabbed hold of God, now I don't have any obligation over here in the world, in these lawful relations. Right? And that's really a lot of what's going on in that whole chapter, Numbers 30, if you read that, There's a lot of discussion of this in different ways. All right? All vows are made in the exercise of covenanting, as Jacob's vow at Bethel, when he received God's gracious covenant promise. So let's look at that again in Genesis 28, 20-22.
Genesis 28, 20-22, and Jacob vowed a vow, saying, if God will be with me and will keep me in this way that I go, and will give me bread to eat and raiment to put on, so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then shall the Lord be my God. And this stone which I have set for a pillar shall be God's house, and of all that thou shalt give me, I will surely give the tenth unto thee.
Right, so what does he do in vowing the vow? He's taking hold of God. And why is he doing it? Because that's what he's doing in the vow. But he's grabbing hold of the covenant of God. He's assuming a voluntary obligation and placing himself in this relation that is making a claim on this covenant. So there's an exercise of covenanting. There's always vowing in covenanting. Which is why we're talking about it. Right? All covenanting is going to involve vowing. Not all vowing will involve covenanting in the broader sense we're going to be talking about it, but there is an exercise of covenanting in all vowing in this sense, that all vowing involves taking hold of the covenant of God. Right? And it has to. Why? Because it is an act of religious worship. And we can't worship God apart from Christ. So we have to approach God through Christ always in order to be acceptable. For our services to be acceptable, it has to go through Christ, the mediator. There's no way to get to God apart from Jesus Christ. The idea that you can have a vow apart from Christ, the idea, we'll see this in a moment, that you can have an oath that's worth anything apart from Christ is a fantasy, a fairy tale. Or more sinisterly, a demonic suggestion. Right? It's a satanic suggestion. We have the case of Israel testifying they agreed to the promise of the covenant made at Sinai. Look at Exodus 34:11.
Exodus 34:11. Observe thou that which I command thee this day. Behold, I drive out before thee the Amorite, the Canaanite, and the Hittite, and the Perizzite, and the Hivite, and the Jebusite.
Yeah, so God promises them that at Sinai, right? That covenant promise. They testify, they agree to that when they make their vow at Hormah for deliverance. Look at Numbers 21, 2 and 3.
Numbers 21, verses 2 and 3. And Israel vowed a vow unto the Lord and said, if thou wilt indeed deliver this people into my hand, then I will utterly destroy their cities. And the Lord hearkened to the voice of Israel and delivered up the Canaanites. And they utterly destroyed them and their cities. And he called the name of the place Hormah.
Yeah, Hormah, or utter destruction. That's what Hormah means. Anyway, what are they doing at Hormah? What they vow? They're actually taking hold of the covenant of God, aren't they? What they're saying is, we accept the term of that covenant. We'll do what you told us to do. We expect you to do what you said you would do. That promise you made there. They're taking hold of the covenant by vowing. That's what's going on. So, a vow, like an oath, binds the soul. It forms a bond. And the word here is asar, bond, or oath, and we're going to see that, you see that a number of times. But anyway, let's look at Numbers 30, verse 9.
Numbers 30, verse 9. But every vow of a widow and of her that is divorced, wherewith they have bound their souls, shall stand against her.
Yeah, it's a binding of the soul. And it's a binding of the soul because it's the soul taking hold of that covenant of God. You voluntarily now grabbed hold of that. God made a promise to you, tendered a promise. By faith, you vow to take hold of that covenant. This bond is, by the way, also noted to be a covenanted bond. And the word is Masoreth. Look at Ezekiel 20, verse 37.
Ezekiel 20, verse 37. And I will cause you to pass under the rod, and I will bring you into the bond of the covenant.
The bond of the covenant, Masoreth. Do you, anybody remember what the Hebrew text that we use is called? The Masoretic text, right? And what that means is the covenanted text. It's the Hebrew text that we have because a bunch of Jews covenanted to preserve the text of God. Were they under that obligation to do so? Absolutely. But they took hold of that covenant obligation and looked for a blessing in it. That's the point. That's why they called themselves Masoretes. They were in a covenant bond. So they understood themselves to be those who had made a vow or covenanters with God regarding the text. All right, question two. What ought we to think of oaths? Again, oaths too must be considered in relation to covenanting. Look at Genesis 26, 28.
Genesis 26, verse 28. And they said, we saw certainly that the Lord was with thee, and we said, let there be now an oath betwixt us, even betwixt us and thee, and let us make a covenant with thee.
Yeah, so we see already early on in the Bible that oaths and covenants are somehow related, don't we? So to enter into an oath is the same as to give it. And it's also to swear. So look at Genesis 26:3 and Joshua 2:17.
Genesis 26:3. Sojourn in this land, and I will be with thee, and will bless thee. For unto thee and unto thy seed I will give all these countries, and I will perform the oath which I swear unto Abraham thy father.
Joshua 2, verse 17. And the men said unto her, we will be blameless of this thine oath which thou hast made us swear.
Right, now, one of the Hebrew verbs denoting to swear is Allah. Genesis 24, 41.
Genesis 24, verse 41. Then shalt thou be clear from this my oath when thou comest to my kindred, and if they give not thee one, thou shalt be clear from my oath.
My oath, and it's actually, I believe it's a participial form that's being used here, but the root word is Allah, and it's derived from the word which signifies God. That's important. Eloah. El is in Psalm 77:14. Eloah, in Deuteronomy 32:15.
Psalm 77, verse 14. Thou art the Lord that doest wonders. Thou hast declared thy strength among the people.
Deuteronomy 32, verse 15. But Jeshurun waxed fat and kicked. Thou art waxen fat. Thou art grown thick. Thou art covered with fatness. Then he forsook God, which made him and lightly esteemed the rock of his salvation.
Yeah, he forsook God, Eloah. And you know, El is a singular. Eloah is a dual, and then there's the plural, Elohim. And, you know, if you think about that, it sounds like we could be talking about one, two, three. Right? This word for God, and this is important. God, Elohim, which is the most common form, it appears in Genesis 1:1. God, in the beginning, God, Elohim. It's very common. God, therefore, is a title which speaks to the nature of the deity and indicates that the bond of unity between the three divine persons, that intra-Trinitarian unity, I'm not talking about the economical Trinity, the works of God and God's unity in his purposes, but that intra-Trinitarian, the inner workings, if you will, of the deity, the three persons and their relations, is not only natural, being rooted in the Father, John 5:26.
John 5:26. For as the Father hath life in himself, so hath he given to the Son to have life in himself.
But it's also voluntary, dependent upon mutual swearing of the three persons. Hebrews 6:17.
Hebrews 6:17. Wherein God, willing more abundantly to show unto the heirs of promise the immutability of his counsel, confirmed it by an oath.
So Elohim, Elohim is, I think, the same as saying the ones who swear, the ones who enter into oaths, right? The ones who are oath-bound, if you will. And that's the voluntary unity. So there's not only a natural unity, which is necessary, but there's this voluntary unity, right? And that's, see, it's exactly where God is voluntary, when there's no necessity of nature, in the sense that there's this natural unity in the Father, but there's this voluntary unity arising from the fact that these are the ones who swear or enter into covenant, which we already talked about, the covenant of redemption, right, as to the purpose of God respecting his creation. Well, here we see that it is, in some sense, that in of the voluntary nature, but it's intra-Trinitarian for God to act in this manner, to be concerned in this respect. The corresponding noun for oath, Allah, again, it looks very much the same, bears the meaning of calling upon the holy and sacred name. We see that, for example, 1 Kings 8:31.
1 Kings 8:31. If any man trespass against his neighbor, and an oath be laid upon him to cause him to swear, and the oath come before thine altar in this house.
For elsewhere, when a different Hebrew verb is used for oath, Shabbah, the same concern to swear by the name of God appears. So when that word is used in a couple places, like it's used in a number of places as well, Genesis 24:3 and Leviticus 19:12.
Genesis 24:3. And I will make thee swear by the Lord, the God of heaven and the God of the earth, that thou shalt not take a wife unto my son of the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I dwell. Leviticus 19:12. And you shall not swear by my name falsely, neither shalt thou profane the name of thy God. I am the Lord.
And I want you to just take note that this word for oath, Shabbat, is probably etymologically related to the word Shabbat, Sabbath. This idea of vowing and oath-taking with God in the relation to the creation is bound up intimately in the first table of the law. It's by the name of the Lord alone and by him alone that we ought to swear. Deuteronomy 6:13.
Deuteronomy 6:13, thou shalt fear the Lord thy God and serve him and shall swear by his name.
So the names of the gods of the heathen were not to be mentioned, nor any creatures taken into such. Look at Matthew 5:34-36.
Matthew 5:34-36. But I say unto you, swear not at all, neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, nor by the earth, for it is his footstool, neither by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Neither shalt thou swear by thy head, because thou canst not make one hair white or black.
Okay, so we're to swear or take an oath only with reference to the holy and sacred name of God. Why? Because that the nature of the deity the nature of the Creator is to swear. Like there's something about this. It's been revealed to us. There's something about that nature that is bound up in this idea of covenanting, swearing. So in any oath, are we allowed to take an oath in the name of any other God than the true God? No. It's not allowable. Right? The confession says we have to take an oath in the sense of the person imposing the oath. We can't impose our own sense upon it. That's what the Jesuits do. It's called mental reservation. We are not allowed to do that. It's immoral. It's wicked. That kind of Jesuitical equivocation is evil in oath-taking. So what do we do? Well, the fact is, we can't take an oath any more than we can take a vow, but an oath is going to be something that we're going to see a little bit more in society. But we can't take an oath that is being tendered by someone who doesn't believe in the true God, doesn't profess belief in the true God. Simply can't. It's not an oath. That's an act of idolatry. It's absolute wickedness. Violation of the third commandment. All right, the expression "the Lord liveth" is a form of oath-taking. Look at Jeremiah 5, 2 and Jeremiah 4, 2.
Jeremiah 5, verse 2. And then they say, "the Lord liveth," surely they swear falsely.
Jeremiah 4, 2. And thou shalt swear, "the Lord liveth in truth and judgment and in righteousness, and the nations shall bless themselves in him, and in him shall they glory."
That's a form of oath-taking because it's doing what? It's acknowledging the God who is in covenant. It's acknowledging that God is a covenant God. That name, the Lord, is that covenant name. Right? Jehovah. Yahweh. It's that sacred name that calls attention to that covenant that covenant relation that exists between God and his creatures. Moreover, the oath is to be taken with the lifting up of the right hand. Look at Daniel 12:7 and Revelation 10, 5 and 6.
Daniel 12, verse 7, "And I heard the man clothed in linen, which was upon the waters of the river, when he held up his right hand and his left hand unto heaven, and swear by him that liveth forever, that it shall be for a time, times, and in half, and when he shall have accomplished to scatter the power of the holy people, all these things shall be finished."
Revelation 10, 5 and 6. "And the angel which I saw stand upon the sea and upon the earth lifted up his hand to heaven, and swear by him that liveth forever and ever, who created heaven, and the things that therein are, and the earth, and the things that therein are, and the sea, and the things which are therein, that there should be time no longer."
Now, whether the right hand is specifically mentioned, it is to be understood as being used. Look at Isaiah 62:8.
Isaiah 62, verse 8. "The Lord has sworn by his right hand and by the arm of his strength, surely I will no more give thy corn to be meat for thine enemies, and the sons of the stranger shall not drink thy wine, for the which thou hast labored."
Right, so in speaking of his promise to the children of Israel, it's called a swearing, and it's also called the lifting of the hand. Look first at Exodus 33:1 and then Ezekiel 20, verse 28.
Exodus 33, verse 1. "And the Lord said unto Moses, Depart, And go up hence, thou and the people which thou hast brought up out of the land of Egypt, unto the land which I swear unto Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, saying, unto thy seed will I give it. Ezekiel 20, verse 28. For when I have brought them into the land for the which I lifted up my hand to give it to them, then they saw every high hill and all the thick trees, and they offered there their sacrifices, and there they presented the provocation of their offering. There also they made their sweet savor and poured out there their drink offerings.
Okay, so we see by comparing those two, swearing and lifting up the hand, same thing. And lifting up the hand, he's talking about his right hand. And so what? Why is it when, you know, all these different government functions, they begin with, a lot of times with, you know, raise your right hand, put your hand on the Bible. That's, of course, putting your hand on the Bible is superstition. It's part of the, it's part of that popish observance where they tend to revere the Bible. They tend to carry it. A lot of times they'll carry it around and reverence the Bible as if there was something inherently to be praised about the Bible itself, when in fact they may not be quite as concerned about what it actually says. But this idea of raising the right hand, that's telling you that they know that what they're doing is an oath and that they're making an appeal to God. Now, the question is, are they making an appeal to the true God or not? Well, if they're telling you to make an appeal to the God of, you know, your belief, that is already telling you their God is not the God of the Bible. Because their God is Christian, Muslim, Jew, Wiccan. It's Arminian, it's Episcopalian, Baptist, Presbyterian, whatever. None of it really matters. And by the way, now they've actually reduced it to, and it doesn't even have to be God. We'll talk about that in a minute too. But that just destroys, you know, atheism. Just rips the heart out of any idea of oath taking. But the fact is that all oath taking, an oath is part of the worship of God, and it's included in the exercises of such worship. Again, Deuteronomy 6:13.
Deuteronomy 6:13. Thou shalt fear the Lord thy God and serve him, and shalt swear by his name.
Now, additionally, in a parallel passage, sacrifice appears in place of swearing. But swearing is not to do sacrifice. It's to perform another part of worship. So let's think about this. Look at 2 Kings 17:36.
2 Kings 17:36. But the Lord who brought you up out of the land of Egypt with great power and a stretched out arm, him shall ye fear, him shall ye worship, and to him shall ye do sacrifice.
Yeah, to him, doing sacrifice, again, is not the same as swearing. Sacrifice is one thing, swearing is something else. Right? But they're all forms of worship. They're all related to the worship of God. Swearing is a form of calling on the name of God, which is regarded as demonstrating a concern for devout obedience to him. That's the idea. We swear, we're showing that we have a concern for devout obedience to him. Look at Isaiah 45:23.
Isaiah 45:23. I have sworn by myself, the word has gone out of my mouth in righteousness and shall not return, that unto me every knee shall bow, every tongue shall swear.
So, again, oaths are part of the worship of God. And you can't dismiss that. You can't belittle that. You can't place that over here and say, well, but I'm not worshiping God when I take this oath. You are, and you're either worshiping the true God or you're worshiping an idol. There's no in between. An oath is a solemn appeal to God, invoking God as a witness that such a statement is true. Whether it's an assertion of fact or a pledge of a promise. Look at 2 Corinthians 1:23.
2 Corinthians 1, verse 23. Moreover, I call God for a record upon my soul, that to spare you I came not as yet unto Corinth.
He calls God as a witness. Why? It's an oath. He's really making an oath. He does this a lot. I'm going to show you a few of them here in the section, but Paul does this a lot. He's making a lot of oaths in the New Testament. Right. As such, then, an unregenerate man cannot be accepted in it. But a true Christian making an oath lawfully will be approved of God. Look at Romans 1:9.
Romans 1:9. For God is my witness, whom I serve with my spirit in the gospel of his Son, that without ceasing I make mention of you always in my prayers.
So God is his witness, but how can an unregenerate man, how can an irreligious man, how can a non-Christian really say that? They can't. They don't know who God is. They are still, as Paul would say elsewhere, they're without God in this world. So first, when an oath is used in religious exercises, strictly personal, it's sworn only to confirm the truth, like, for example, Romans 9:1.
Romans 9:1, I say the truth in Christ, I lie not, my conscience also bearing me witness in the Holy Ghost.
Yeah, he's making an oath there. He's called an assertory oath, because an assertion is made before God in giving adherence to the truth. And acquiescing in the truth, and implying an obligation to abide by the truth in solemn declaration of obligation to God. Paul does this again a lot. Galatians 1:20 is another example.
Galatians 1:20. Now the things which I read into you, behold, before God I lie not.
Yeah, before God I lie not. In other words, he's making an assertory oath that what he's saying is true. He's appealing to God as the vindicator, a witness to what he's saying, and you know, ultimately a judge if he's wrong. That's what an oath is doing. It's an appeal to God. And so Israel was invited to acquiesce in the truth contained in the words of God, and in so doing, to accede to his covenant, taking hold of it by faith in their assertory oath. Jeremiah 4:1-2.
Jeremiah 4:1-2. If thou wilt return, O Israel, saith the Lord, return unto me, and if thou wilt put away thine abominations out of my sight, then shalt thou not remove. And thou shalt swear, the Lord liveth in truth and judgment and in righteousness, and the nations shall bless themselves in him, and in him shall they glory.
So they're taking hold of the covenant of God by faith in their assertory oath. They're by taking hold of the truth, oath bound, taking hold of the truth, they're taking hold of the covenant of God. A second, when an oath is given to confirm an assertion by men having a right to claim it, those call upon the party to be sworn to promise to speak the truth, and they invoke God as witness. Again, Hebrews 6:16.
Hebrews 6:16. For men verily swear by the greater, and an oath for confirmation is to them an end of all strife.
Now, The fact is this, the law of God requires the fulfillment of every promise made by man to man. Proverbs 12:22, for example.
Proverbs 12:22, lying lips are abomination to the Lord, but they that deal truly are his delight.
So you're already under an obligation to tell the truth. What's the point of an assertory oath then? The point of it is twofold. You have a natural obligation to tell the truth. It's a matter of morality, fundamental morality. But by an assertory oath, you are voluntarily owning that obligation and at the same time taking hold of the covenant of grace for the strength and power to perform it. Why is that necessary? In serious matters, why is that necessary? Remember what Paul says? All men are liars. You can't tell the truth unless God, by his Spirit, is working in you. You know, apart from God, you're of your father, the devil. Right? He's the father of lies, and you're going to lie just like him. Your fallen nature is prone to lying. You go astray from the womb. You're just all fallen men love to lie. By this assertory oath, you're acknowledging that despite the love in your flesh that you acknowledge that there is, number one, this higher obligation to obey God rather than man, including yourself, and that the power to do so does not lie within yourself. You're laying hold of this obligation, and you're also, at the same time in the oath, making an appeal to God for the strength to fulfill it. By penning an oath, then, God is appealed to as witness and judge, and he becomes a party to the covenant between the oath taker and himself, so that an engagement to God, as well as man, is explicitly constituted in that oath-taking. Look at 2 Chronicles 6, 22 and 23.
2 Chronicles 6, verses 22 and 23. If a man sin against his neighbor, and an oath be laid upon him to make him swear, and the oath come before thine altar in this house, then hear thou from heaven, and do and judge thy servants by requiting the wicked, by recompensing his way upon his own head, and by justifying the righteous, by giving him according to his righteousness.
The oath places an additional obligation. However, the oath also constitutes a taking hold of that covenant and an appeal to the grace of God for the strength to keep that oath. Now, that's an assertory oath. When an oath is represented as a promissory oath, it's used in reference to obligation to be fulfilled in the future, whether near or far, but it's a future obligation. So, for example, Nehemiah 5:12.
Nehemiah 5, verse 12. Then said they, we will restore them and will require nothing of them, so we will do as thou sayest. Then I called the priests and took an oath of them that they should do according to this promise.
Okay, so whereas a vow is a promise made to God, look at Deuteronomy 23, 21, and 22.
Deuteronomy 23, verses 21 and 22. When thou shalt vow a vow unto the Lord thy God, thou shalt not slack to pay it. For the Lord thy God will surely require it of thee, and it would be sin in thee. But if thou shalt forbear to vow, it shall be no sin in thee.
An oath, on the other hand, is a promise made to another wherein God shall require it no less than what is vowed to himself. Okay, so vow is a promise made directly to God, An oath is a promise made to another, but God is still involved. Because both bind the soul. Numbers 30, verse 2.
Numbers 30, verse 2. If a man vow a vow unto the Lord, or swear an oath to bind his soul with a bond, he shall not break his word. He shall do according to all that proceedeth out of his mouth.
Thus then, when the tribes of Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh, if you remember the story in the Bible, they stop on the other side, Transjordan. They stop to the east of the Promised Land, and they claim land. Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh, the half tribe of Manasseh, they swear unto their brethren there, right? They swear. And in doing so, they testify to their conviction that a failure in fulfilling their promise would actually be a breach of an engagement to God himself. So they're swearing, I want you to consider that, they're swearing to the other tribes, the children of the other tribes, but they're acknowledging if they fail, if they come short, that in coming short, they're actually sinning against God himself. That's the point here. So let's look at Joshua 22, 21 to 23.
Joshua 22, 21 to 23. Then the children of Reuben and the children of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh answered and said unto the heads of the thousands of Israel, the Lord God of gods, the Lord God of gods, he knoweth, and Israel he shall know. If it be in rebellion, or if in transgression against the Lord, save us not this day, that we have built us an altar to turn from following the Lord, or if to offer thereon burnt offering or meat offering, or if to offer peace offerings thereon, let the Lord himself require it.
So in other words, they are explicit in their acknowledgement that their oath is going to be enforced by God. They fully expect it. The oath is made to the other tribes, but by taking this oath, they have themselves taken hold of the covenant of God. They've also called God to be witness and judge in this matter. If they don't perform what they've promised to do now, they expect divine judgment. So, every giving of an oath for confirmation, whether of a statement of fact or of a promise to be fulfilled in the future, every giving of an oath is in every case taking hold of taking hold on the covenant of God. For the hand lifted in the devotion of an oath points out reconciliation and, in fact, points to heaven, wherewith this oath binds to the covenant. We'll look at Ezekiel 17:18.
Ezekiel 17, verse 18. Seeing he despised the oath by breaking the covenant, when lo, he had given his hand, and hath done all these things, he shall not escape.
Yeah, there's a binding, right, to the covenant by oath. And therefore, when men, in making a league or a covenant with one another, lawfully vow or lawfully swear to the Lord, a covenant with him. Go to Ezekiel 17, 19.
Ezekiel 17, verse 19. Therefore, thus saith the Lord God, as I live, surely mine oath that he hath despised, my covenant that he hath broken, even it will I recompense upon his own head.
We see oath and covenant used interchangeably there because the one represents the other, because in that oath there's been a taking hold. And so too the covenant made between David and Jonathan by swearing unto God is also noted to be a covenant of the Lord. And we can see this particularly if we compare 1 Samuel 20 verse 8 and 2 Samuel 21 7.
Samuel 20, verse 8. Therefore thou shalt deal kindly with thy servant, for thou hast brought thy servant into a covenant of the Lord with thee, notwithstanding that there be in me iniquity, slay me thyself. but why shouldest thou bring me to thy father? 2 Samuel 21, verse 7, but the king spared Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, because of the Lord's oath that was between them, between David and Jonathan, the son of Saul.
Likewise, the covenant of marriage made by vowing or swearing to the Lord is recognized as a covenant of God. Proverbs 2:17.
Proverbs 2:17, which forsaketh the guide of her youth and forgetteth the covenant of her God.
So, there is in marriage, there's a vow to God, there's an oath to one another, and there's a covenant made with the family and the church and society. So all of these things that we're talking about are involved. This is why there needs to be a taking hold of covenant with God. And this is exactly why believers should not be entering into marriages with unbelievers. Unbelievers, they're going to make this vow to whom? Their oath is going to be calling what God? True God? The covenant is going to be what? You know, there's an entire assault upon God himself when we enter into covenants, when we enter into oaths, when we take vows, but not to the true God. Right? So as we sort of finish up here, there are a few things I want to consider then from this, what we've been talking about. The civil or moral use of the oath within a society depends upon the spiritual character of that society. Look at Genesis 26, verse 28.
And they said, "We saw certainly that the Lord was with thee. And we said, let there be now an oath betwixt us, even betwixt us and thee, and let us make a covenant with thee."
Yeah, that's actually that's a proper thing. You know, they've come to see that God is with his people, and then they want to call that God to witness. Now we're dealing with the true God. You couldn't have that without that. That's why elsewhere in the law, I didn't write down any of the verses here, but you can look them up. There are several verses where the Bible says explicitly, we're not to enter into covenant with unbelievers. We're not to serve their gods. It actually joins those things together. Why is it joining that stuff together? Because when you take an oath to an immoral, ungodly, Christless government, you are entering into a covenant to serve their gods. You are rejecting the true God. I want you to understand this, because the covenanter position regarding political dissent with respect to the governments of the world that are not in covenant with Christ is really rooted in not some peripheral view of the doctrine of social covenanting like people would like to have you believe. If you talk to them very long, they're going to say, well, Reformed Presbyterians are peculiar in this way. They have this peculiar regard for these covenants, and it's almost idolatrous. Well, that's the way every covenant breaker speaks. You don't have a right to go back on your word to God. right? If it was done lawfully. And when we consider the doctrine of oaths and vows, a proper application, understanding what is involved in oaths and vows, you don't even need to understand anything about the solemn league and covenant per se to understand that you're going to have a problem engaging politically with a nation that is cast out of step with Christ, the mediator. Right? You're going to have a problem with any nation who has a God other than the true God when it comes to this doctrine of oaths and vows. Now, we're going to help, you know, refine this problem and make it more more apparent as we get closer and closer to talking about the national covenant, the Solemn League and Covenant, and covenant renewal at Arkansas, and all of that, the Arkansas renovation. All of that is these are all things which flow from the doctrine of oaths and vows, a proper understanding of the doctrine of oaths and vows. Okay, we're setting down large and broad principles right now. That when we get to these other things, we're going to see that all of this really points in one direction. Whether it's popular or not, it doesn't really matter. Right? The question is, are we going to cast off the first table of the law? Because ultimately, it's no mistaking that these non-covenanters eventually come to throw away the regulative principle when it comes to matters of worship, for example. They've already profaned the name of God, right? And so God turns them over to that judgment, and they will eventually be worshiping other gods unless they repent. So the oath of an atheist or an unbeliever is not necessarily of any value whatsoever. I want to look at something that Solomon says in Ecclesiastes 9:2.
Ecclesiastes 9, verse 2. All things come alike to all. There is one event to the righteous and to the wicked, to the good and to the clean and to the unclean, and to him that sacrificeth and to him that sacrificeth not. And as the good, so is the sinner. And he that sweareth as he that feareth an oath.
Yeah, there's a sense in which, you know, Solomon says, I mean, death comes alike to all. But one of the categories he puts in there is he who makes an oath and he who fears an oath. That is, the one who's not in a position. The one who makes the oath is the good. Right? The one who fears the oath is a sinner, if you look in that verse. So, in terms of death, well, yeah, it comes to light to all, but does this verse mean that an oath is of no value to the one who's taking it? No. What we see actually is that there are these distinctions. Yes, there are certain things that come to all men, but there are these distinctions in our society. There are some men who are capable of taking oaths and some men who aren't. And so people who don't fear God, people who are unbelievers or atheists, they can't. The fact is, an individual who has no sense of responsibility to God for his actions will not always, if at any time, scruple to swear falsely.
Ezekiel 16:59. For thus saith the Lord God, I will even deal with thee as thou hast done, which has despised the oath and breaking the covenant.
Yeah, why did they despise the oath and break the covenant? Because they're unbelievers. You know, there's an element of unbelief. Right? If you believe, you're not going to do that. What's going to stop someone? You know, if you don't believe in God, or you don't really think that God sees, or your views of God are not the true God, how is your oath going to stand up for anything? I mean, if you take an oath of someone of that mindset, there's a reason why in the colonial days of North America and in the United States, if you didn't believe in final punishments, you weren't even eligible to take an oath of office. Now, did they go far enough? No, of course not. You know, if you don't believe in the true God, you're going to feel yourself at liberty to play fast and loose with the truth in areas that you think don't pertain to truth, objective truth. So now we've come to a point where, you know, you can't, asking people to swear an oath now, the only thing they can do is they can try to enforce it with some sort of temporal punishment, because they're dealing with a bunch of people who have absolutely no fear of God. There's no fear of God in this society. And so there's no guarantee that anyone, even under oath, is going to tell you the truth. There's no guarantee. Doesn't even approximate it. For Christians to bind themselves up in that kind of mess is, again, its own problem. In civil and moral life, the presumption that a witness is competent should be based at least on the profession he makes regarding divine truth. Psalm 14:1.
The fool hath said in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. They have done abominable works. There is none that doeth good.
Yeah, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. You know, the fact is this. Fools are not reliable. Like, they're not going to give you an accurate assessment of truth. They're not going to be faithful witnesses for anything. And of course, they're going to have no scruples about swearing falsely. I mean, they may know it's wrong. In fact, I would assert they do know it's wrong. But they're suppressing that truth and unrighteousness. And therefore they're not reliable. You know, they're covenant breakers. They're going to go to war with God over this stuff. They're willing to. Because they don't even view it as a big deal. And they just don't see it as a big deal. And finally, an oath is distinct from a vow. The latter, the vow, is a solemn promise to God. Again, that idea that we're dealing with God alone in a vow. Psalm 76:11.
Vow and pay unto the Lord your God. Let all that be round about him bring presents unto him that ought to be feared.
Whereas the former, the oath, is an appeal to God. It's 2 Kings 11:4.
2 Kings 11:4. In the seventh year, Jehoiada sent and fetched the rulers over hundreds with the captains and the guard, and brought them to him into the house of the Lord, and made a covenant with them, and took an oath of them in the house of the Lord, and showed them the king's son.
So the swearing of an oath always brings under obligation to God. And therefore, swearing an oath always includes making a vow. Look at Numbers 30:10.
Numbers 30:10. And if she vowed in her husband's house, or bound her soul by a bond with an oath.
So let me ask you this question. Does a vow always involve an oath? No. But an oath always involves a vow. Okay. When men covenant with one another and appeal to God by oath, they come under an engagement to him and also an engagement to one another. And we see this if we look at Genesis 50, verse 25, and then compare it with what happens in Exodus 13, 19.
Genesis 50, verse 25. And Joseph took an oath to the children of Israel, saying, God will surely visit you, and ye shall carry up my bones from hence. Exodus 13, verse 19. And Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for he had assuredly sworn the children of Israel, saying, God will surely visit you, and ye shall carry up my bones away hence with you.
Yeah, and we're going to get into that a little bit more. That does show the descending obligation of covenants, because it was not the generation that was bound by Joseph, right, that take up the bones. So, but we see that there is an oath that's taken, an engagement to one another that takes in God, and this taking in of God means that this oath is going to be performed. It has to be performed, whether near or far in the future, by those who've come under obligation. So eventually we're going to have to talk about the concept of moral person and that sort of thing. But anyway, for now, just understand that part of it. They vow and swear to God and promise and swear to one another. Look at Genesis 31, 13, and 44.
Genesis 31, 13. I am the God of Bethel, where thou anointest the pillar, and where thou vowest a vow unto me. Now arise, get thee out from this land, and return unto the land of thy kindred. And verse 44. Now therefore come thou, let us make a covenant, I and thou, and let it be for a witness between me and thee.
Yeah, so there, you see, if we were to read through the whole chapter, you'll see they're vowing and swearing to God is the basis upon which they are going to promise and swear to one another, make that covenant with one another. So these things are all involved. You know, at the center of the oath is the vow. At the center of covenanting is the oath and the vow. And we'll see that more when we get into covenanting. But anyway, so when an oath is enjoined, so is a vow. Look at Joshua 2, 17 and 18.
Joshua 2, verses 17 and 18. And the men said unto her, we will be blameless of this thine oath which thou hast made us swear. Behold, when we come into the land, thou shalt bind this line of scarlet thread in the window which thou didst let us down by. And thou shalt bring thy father and thy mother and thy brethren and all thy father's household home unto thee.
Yeah, so they made an oath with Rahab, right? And that oath is dependent upon a vow. How do we know that? Because of that scarlet cord. She's got to take hold of that covenant of grace. And if she doesn't do it, she's not going to be saved. So there's already a point to that. And the reason is that which is promised to God in the oath is a vow. So remember, in every oath, there's a promise being made to God too. And that's a vow. Joshua 24, 15, 24, and 25.
Joshua 24, verse 15. And if it seem evil, unto you to serve the Lord, choose you this day whom ye will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served that were on the other side of the flood, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land ye dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. And verses 24 and 25. And the people said unto Joshua and the Lord, or the Lord our God, will we serve, and his voice will we obey. So Joshua made a covenant with them, or with the people that day, and set them a statute and an ordinance in Shechem.
So again, an oath has in it a vow. It always has. And a covenant, as we're going to see, has both aspects of oath and vow in it. All right? So next time, what we want to look at, though, is we want to look at the idea of confession as it is as it relates to this matter of covenanting, and then we'll probably be able to start getting into some of the material covenanting, personal covenanting, and that sort of thing. Right, so that's next time.